Kyrianon and Tyron, they were brought in one by one with 50 retainers, or at most 100. Men and women he trusted even less than he did Gregorin or Samaradrid. Most were men, not because he thought the women any less dangerous. He was not that big a fool. A woman would kill you twice as fast as a man, and usually for half the reason. But because he could not bring himself to take any woman except the most dangerous where he was going. Ailill could smile warmly while she calculated where to plant the knife in your ribs. Annalula, a willowy, simpering high lady who gave a fair imitation of a beautiful goose brain, had returned to Tyr from Carrion and openly begun talking of herself for the as-yet non-existent throne of Tyr. Perhaps she was a fool, but she had managed to gain a great deal of support, both among nobles and in the streets. So he gathered them in, all the folk who had been too long out from under his eye. He could not watch all of them all the time, but he could not afford to let them forget that he did watch sometimes. He gathered them, and he waited. For 2 days. Gnashing his teeth, he waited. 5 days. 8. Rain was beating a diminishing drum on his tent when the last man he was waiting for finally arrived. Shaking a small torrent from his oiled cloth cape, Davram Bashir blew out his thick, gray-streaked mustaches in disgust and tossed the cape over a barrel chair. A short man with a great hooked beak of a nose, he seemed larger than he was. Not because he strutted, but because he assumed that he was as tall as any man present, and other men took him so. Wise men did. The wolf-headed ivory baton of the Marshal General of Saldaea, tucked carelessly behind his sword belt, had been earned on scores of battlefields and at as many council tables. He was one of the very few men Rand would trust with his life. "I know you don't like explaining," Bashir muttered, "but I could use a little illumination." Adjusting his serpentine sword, he sprawled in another chair and flung a leg over the arm of it. He always seemed at ease, but he could uncoil faster than a whip. "That Ashaman fellow wouldn't say more than you needed me yesterday. Yet he said not to bring more than 1,000 men. I only had half that with me, but I brought them. It can't be a battle. Half the sigils I saw out there belong to men who'd bite their tongues if they saw a fellow behind you with a knife, and most of the rest to men who'd try to hold your attention if they hadn't paid the knife man in the first place." Seated behind his writing table in his shirt sleeves, Rand wearily pressed the heels of his palms against his eyes. With Borina Caravan left behind, the lamp wicks needed proper trimming, and a faint haze of smoke hung in the air. Besides, he had been awake most of the night, poring over the maps scattered across the table. Maps of southern Altara. No two agreed on very much. "If you're going to fight a battle," he told Bashir, "who better to pay the butcher's bill than men who want you dead? Anyway, it isn't soldiers who'll win this battle. All they have to do is keep anybody from sneaking up on the Ashaman. What do you think of that?" Bashir snorted so hard that his heavy mustaches stirred. "I think it's a deadly stew, is what I think. Somebody's gonna choke to death on it. The light scented isn't us." And then he laughed, as if that were a fine joke. Luz Theron laughed, too. Chapter 22. Gathering Clouds. Under a steady drizzle, Rand's small army formed columns across the low-folded hills facing the Nemerellan peaks, dark and sharp against the western sky. There was no real need to face the direction you intended to travel, but it always felt askew to Rand otherwise. Despite the rain, rapidly thinning gray clouds let through startlingly bright sunshine, or maybe the day only seemed bright, after all the recent gloom. 4 of the columns were headed by Bashir's Saldaeans, bandy-legged unarmored men in short coats standing patiently beside their mounts beneath a small forest of shining lanceheads, the other 5 by blue-coated men with a dragon on their chests, commanded by a short, stocky fellow named Jack Massand. When Massand moved, it was always with surprising quickness, but he was utterly still now, feet planted astride and hands folded behind his back. His men were in place, and so were the defenders and companions, grumpy about being behind infantry. It was the nobles and their folk, mainly, who milled about as if unsure where to go. Thick mud sucked at hooves and boots and mired cartwheels. Shouted curses rose. It took time to line up nearly 6,000 soaked men, getting wetter by the minute, and that was not counting the supply carts and the remounts. Rand had donned his finest so he would stand out at a glance. Alick with the power had polished the dragon scepter's spearhead to mirror brightness, and another had burnished the crown of swords so the gold gleamed. The gilded dragon buckle of his sword belt caught the light, and so did the thread of gold embroidery that covered his blue silk coat. For a moment he regretted giving away the gems that once had decked his sword's hilt and scabbard. The dark boarhide was serviceable, but any armsman could have worn that. Let men know who he was. Let the Seanchan know who had come to destroy them. Sitting Tidashar on a broad flat, he impatiently watched the nobles roil about on the hills. A little way off on the flat, Gedwin and Rochide sat their saddles in front of their men, all formed into a precise box, dedicated in the front rank, soldiers lined up behind. They looked ready to parade. As many had gray hair, or nearly none, as were young. Several were as young as Hopwill or more, but every one was strong enough to make a gateway. That had been a requirement. Flynn and Dashiva waited behind Rand in a casual cluster with Adley and Moore, Hopwill and Narishma, and a rigid pair of mounted bannermen, one Tyran and one Kyrianen, their breastplates and helmets and even their steel-backed gauntlets buffed and polished till they shone. The crimson banner of light and the long white dragon banner hung limp and dripping. Rand had assumed the power in his tent, where his momentary stagger would not be seen, and the sparse rain failed by an inch to touch him or his horse. The taint on Saidine felt especially heavy today, a thick, foul oil that oozed into his pores and stained his bones deep, stained his soul. He had thought himself accustomed to the vileness, after a fashion, yet today it was nauseating, stronger than the frozen fire and molten cold of Saidine itself. He held on to the source as often as possible now, accepting the vileness to avoid the new sickness of seizing it. It could be deadly if he let sickness distract him from that struggle. Maybe it was connected to the dizzy spells somehow. Light, he could not go mad yet, and he could not die. Not yet. There was too much still to be done. He pressed his left leg against Tidashar's flank just to feel the long bundle strapped beneath stirrup leather and scarlet saddle cloth. Every time he did that, something wriggled across the outside of the void. Anticipation, and maybe a touch of fear. Well-trained, the gelding started to turn left, and Rand had to rein him back. When would the nobles sort themselves out? He ground his teeth in impatience. He could remember as a boy hearing men laugh that when rain fell in sunshine, the Dark One was beating Semirag. Some of that laughter had been uneasy, though, and scrawny old Sen Bui would always snarl that Semirag would be smarting and angry after that, and come for small boys who did not keep out of their elders' way. That had been enough to send Rand running, when he was little. He wished Semirag would come for him now, right that instant. He would make her weep.
"Nothing makes Semirag weep," Luz Theron muttered. "She gives tears to others, but she has none for herself."
Rand laughed softly. If she came today, he would make her weep. Her and the rest of the Forsaken together, if they came today. Most assuredly, he would make the Seanchan weep. Not everyone was pleased with the orders he had given. Suneman's oily smile vanished when he thought Rand did not see. Torion had a flask in his saddlebags, no doubt brandy, or maybe several flasks, because he drank steadily and never appeared to run dry. Samaradrid and Markalin and Tahara each appeared in front of Rand to protest the numbers with somber faces. A few years before, close on 6,000 men would have been army enough for any war. But they had seen armies in the tens of thousands now, hundreds of thousands, as in Arthur Hawkwing's day. And to go against the Seanchan, they wanted far more. He sent them away disgruntled. They did not understand that 50-odd Ashaman were as big a hammer as anyone could wish for. Rand wondered what they would have said had he told them he was hammer enough by himself. He had considered doing this by himself. It might come to that yet. Wireman came. He did not like having to take orders from Bashir, or the fact that they were going into mountains. Very hard to mount a decent charge in mountains. or several other things, Rand was certain there were at least several more, that Rand did not let him utter.
"The Saldaean seems to believe I should ride on the right flank," Wireman muttered disparagingly.
He twisted his shoulders, as though the right flank were a great insult for some reason.
"And the foot, my lord dragon. Really, I think—"
"I think you should get your men ready," Rand said coldly. Part of the chill was the effect of floating in emotionless emptiness. "Or you won't be on any flank." He meant that he would leave the man behind if he were not ready in time. Surely such a fool could not make much trouble left in this remote spot with only a few armsmen. Rand would be back before he could ride to anything larger than a village. Blood drained from Wireman's face, though.
"As my lord dragon commands,"
he said, briskly for him, and whirling his horse away before the words were well out of his mouth. His mount was a tall, deep-chested bay today. The pale lady Ailill reined to a stop in front of Rand, accompanied by the high lady Anaila, a strange pair to be in company, and not just because their nations hated one another. Ailill was tall for a Cairhienin woman, if only for a Cairhienin, and everything about her was dignity and precision, from the arch of her eyebrow, to the turn of her red-gloved wrist, to the way her pearl-collared rain-cape lay spread across the rump of her smoke-gray mare. Unlike Samaradrid, or Markalin, Wireman, or Tehera, she did not so much as blink at the sight of raindrops sliding down nothing around him. Anaila did blink, and gasp, and titter behind her hand. Anaila was willowy and darkly beautiful, her rain-cape collared with rubies and embroidered with gold besides, but there any resemblance to Ailill ended. Anaila was all mincing elegance and simpers. When she bowed, her white gelding did too, bending its forelegs. The prancing animal was showy, but Rand suspected it had no bottom, like its mistress.
"My lord dragon," Ailill said, "I must make one more protest against my inclusion in this expedition."
Her voice was coolly neutral, if not exactly unfriendly.
"I will send my retainers where you command and when, but I have no desire at all to be in the thick of a battle." "Oh, no," Anaila added, with a delicate shudder.
Even her tone simpered.
"Nasty things, battles, so my master of the horse says. Surely you won't really make us go, my lord dragon. We've heard you have a particular care for women, haven't we, Ailill?"
Rand was so astonished that the void collapsed and Saiyadeen vanished. Raindrops began to trickle through his hair and seep through his coat. But for a moment, clutching his saddle's high pommel to hold himself upright, seeing four women instead of two, he was too stunned to notice. How much did they know? They had heard? How many people knew? How did anyone know? Light. Rumor had him killing Morgays, Elaine, Colliver. 100 women, probably, and each in a worse way than the last. He swallowed against the urge to sick up. That was only partly Saiyadeen's fault.
Burn me. How many spies are there watching me?
The thought was a growl.
"The dead watch," Luz Theron whispered. "The dead never close their eyes."
Rand shivered. "I do try to be careful of women," he told them when he could speak. "Faster than a man, and for half the reason. That's why I want to keep you close the next few days. But if you really dislike the idea so much, I could tell one of the Ashaman. You'd be safe at the Black Tower."
Anaila squeaked prettily, but her face went gray. "Thank you, no,"
Ailill said after a moment, absolutely calm.
"I suppose I had best confer with my lands captain about what to expect."
But she paused in turning her mare away, and regarded Rand with a sidelong look.
"My brother Toram is impetuous, my lord dragon. Even rash. I am not."
Anaila smiled much too sweetly at Rand, and actually wriggled slightly before following. But once she faced away from him, she dug in her heels and worked her jewel-handled quirt, quickly passing the other woman. That white gelding showed a surprising turn of speed. At last all was ready. The columns formed, snaking back over the low hills.
"Begin," Rand told Gedwin,
who wheeled his horse and began barking orders to his man. The eight dedicated rode forward and dismounted on the ground they had memorized, facing the mountains. One of them looked familiar. A grizzled fellow, whose pointed Tyran beard appeared odd on his wrinkled countryman's face. Eight vertical lines of sharp blue light turned and became openings that showed slightly different views of a long, sparsely wooded mountain valley, rising to a steep pass. In Altara. In the Venir Mountains.
Kill them, Luz Theron wept pleadingly.
They're too dangerous to live.
Without thought, Rand suppressed the voice. Another man channeling often brought that reaction from Luz Theron, or even a man who could. He no longer wondered why. Rand muttered a command, and Flynn blinked in surprise before hurrying to join the line and weave a ninth gateway. None was as large as Rand could make, but any would pass a cart, if closely. He had intended to do that himself, but he did not want to chance seizing Saidin again in front of everyone. He noticed Gedwin and Rochide watching him, wearing identical knowing smiles. And Dashiva as well, frowning, lips moving as he talked to himself. Was it his imagination, or was Narishma eyeing him askance too? And Adly? More? Rand shivered before he could stop himself. Mistrust of Gedwin and Rochide was simple sense, but was he coming down with what Nynaeve had called the dreads? A kind of madness? A crippling dark suspicion of everyone and everything? There had been a Coplin, Benley, who thought everybody was scheming against him. He had starved to death when Rand was a boy, refusing to eat for fear of poison. Ducking low on Tadashar's neck, Rand heeled the gelding through the largest gateway. Flynn's, as it happened, but he would have ridden through one made by Gedwin right then. He was the first onto Altaran soil. The others followed quickly, the Ashaman first of all. Dashiva started in Rand's direction, frowning, and Narishma too, but Gedwin immediately began directing his soldiers. One by one, they rushed forward, opened a gateway, and darted through, dragging their mounts behind them. Ahead up the valley, bright flashes of light told of gateways opening and closing. The Ashaman could travel short distances without first memorizing the ground they left from, and cover ground far easier than riding. In short order, only Gedwin and Rochide remained, aside from the dedicated holding the gateways. The others would be fanning out westward, searching for Seanchan. The Saldaeans were through from Ilion and mounting. Legion men spread into the trees at a trot, crossbows held ready. In this country, they could move as fast afoot as men on horseback. As the rest of the army began emerging, Rand rode up the valley in the direction the Ashaman had gone. Mountains rose high behind him, a wall fronting the deep. But west, the peaks ran almost to Abu Dhar. He quickened the gelding's pace to a canter. Bashir caught him before he reached the pass. The man's bay was small. Most of the Saldaeans rode small horses, but quick. "No Seanchan here, it seems," he said almost idly, stroking his mustaches with a knuckle. "But there could have been. Tanobi is likely to have my head on a pike soon enough for following a live dragon reborn. Much more a dead one." Rand scowled. Maybe he could take Flynn to watch his back and Narishma, and... Flynn had saved his life. The man had to be true. Men could change, though. And Narishma? Even after... He felt cold at the risk he had taken. Not the dreads. Narishma had proved true, but it still had been a mad risk. As mad as running from stairs he was not even sure were real, running to where he had no notion what was waiting. Bashir was right, but Rand did not want to talk about it further. The slopes leading up into the pass were bare stone and boulders of all sizes, but among the natural stone lay weathered pieces of what must have once been a huge statue. Some were just recognizable as worked stone, others more so. A beringed hand, nearly big as his chest, gripping a sword hilt with a broken stub of blade wider than his hand. A great head. A woman with cracks across her face and a crown that seemed to be made of upthrusting daggers, some still whole. "Who do you think she was?" he asked. "A queen, of course. Even if merchants or scholars had worn crowns in some distant time, only rulers and generals earned statues." Bashir twisted in his saddle to study the head before speaking.
"A queen of Shayota, I'll wager," he said finally. "Not older. I saw a statue made in Eharon once, and it was so worn you couldn't say whether it was man or woman. A conqueror, or they wouldn't have shown her with a sword. And I seem to recall Shayota gave a crown like that to rulers who expanded the borders. Maybe they called it the Crown of Swords, eh? A brown sister might be able to tell you more."
"It isn't important," Rand told him irritably. "They did look like swords."
Bashir went on anyway, graying eyebrows lowered, gravely serious. "I expect thousands cheered her, called her the hope of Shayota. Maybe even believed she was. In her time, she might have been as feared and respected as Utter Hawkwing was later. But now, even the Brown Sisters may not know her name. When you die, people begin to forget who you were and what you did, or tried to do. Everybody dies eventually, and everybody is forgotten eventually. But there's no bloody point dying before your time comes."
"I don't intend to," Rand said sharply. He knew where he was meant to die, if not when. He thought he did.
The corner of his eye caught motion, back down where bare stone gave way to brush and a few small trees. 50 paces away, a man stepped into the open and raised a bow, smoothly drawing fletchings to cheek. Everything seemed to happen at once. Snarling, Rand hauled Tidashar around, watching the archer adjust to follow. He seized Saideen, and Sweet Life and Filth poured into him together. His head spun. There were 2 archers. Bile rose in his throat as he fought wild, uncontrolled surges of the power that tried to sear him to the bone and freeze his flesh solid. He could not control them. It was all he could do to stay alive. Desperately, he fought to clear his sight, to be able to see well enough to weave the flows he could barely form, with nausea flooding him as strongly as the power. He thought he heard Bashir shout. 2 archers loosed. Rand should have died. At that range, a boy could have hit his target. Maybe being Taviran saved him. As the archer let fly, a covey of gray-winged quail burst up almost at his feet, uttering piercing whistles. Not enough to throw off an experienced man, and indeed the fellow only flinched a hair. Rand felt the wind of the arrow's passage against his cheek. Fireballs the size of fists suddenly struck the archer. He screamed as his arm spun away, hand still gripping the bow. Another took off his left leg at the knee. He fell shrieking. Leaning out of his saddle, Rand vomited onto the ground. His stomach tried to heave up every meal he had ever eaten. The void inside Ian left with a sickening wrench. It was nearly more than he could manage not to fall. When he could sit upright again, he took the white linen handkerchief Bashir silently offered and wiped his mouth. The Saldaean frowned with concern, as well he might. Rand's stomach wanted to find more to spew out. He thought his face must be pale. He drew a deep breath. Losing Saideen that way could kill you. But he could still sense the source. At least Saideen had not burned him out. At least he could see properly. There was only one Davram Bashir. But the illness seemed a little worse each time he seized Saideen. "Let's see if there's enough of this fellow left to talk," he told Bashir. There was not. Rutchide was on his knees, calmly searching through the corpse's torn, blood-stained coat. Besides his missing arm and leg, the dead man had a blackened hole as big as his head all the way through his chest. It was Egan Padros. His sightless eyes stared at the sky in surprise. Gedwin ignored the body at his feet, studying Rand instead, as cold as Rutchide. Both men held Saideen. Surprisingly, Luce Theron only moaned. In a clatter of hooves on stone, Flynn and Arishma came galloping up the rise, followed by nearly 100 Saldaeans. As they came close, Rand could feel the power in the grizzled old man and the younger, maybe as much as they could hold. They had both leaped up in strength since Dumai's Wells. That was the way of it with men. Women seemed to gain smoothly, but men suddenly jumped. Flynn was stronger than Gedwin or Rochide, either one, and Arishma not far behind. For the time being, there was no way to know how it would end. None came close to matching Rand, though. Not yet, anyway. There was no way to tell what time would bring.
not the dreads. "It seems it's well we decided to follow you, my Lord Dragon." Gedwin's voice assumed concern, just shy of mocking. "Are you suffering from a tender stomach this morning?" Rand just shook his head. He could not take his eyes from Pedras's face. Why? Because he had conquered Ilion? Because the man had been loyal to Lord Brend? With a loud exclamation, Rochide ripped a wash leather pouch from Pedras's coat pocket and upended it. Bright golden coins spilled onto the stony ground, bouncing and clinking. 30 crowns, he growled. Tarvalin crowns. No doubt who paid him. He snatched a coin and tossed it up for Rand, but Rand made no effort to catch it, and it glanced off his arm. There's plenty of Tarvalin coin to be found, Bashir said calmly. Half the men in this valley have a few in their pockets. I do myself. Gedwin and Rochide swiveled to look at him. Bashir smiled behind his thick mustaches, or at least showed teeth. But some of the Saldaeans shifted uneasily in their saddles and fingered belt pouches. Up where the pass leveled off for a bit between steep mountain slopes, a slash of light rotated into a gateway, and a top-knotted Shannaran, in a plain black coat, trotted through, pulling his horse behind him. It appeared the first Seanchan had been found, and not too far away if the man was back so quickly. "Time to move," Rand told Bashir. The man nodded, but he did not stir. Instead, he studied the two Ashaman standing near Pedras. They ignored him. "What do we do with him?" Gedwin demanded, gesturing to the corpse. "We ought to send him back to the witches, at least." "Leave him," Rand replied. "Are you ready to kill now?" Luz Theron asked. He did not sound insane at all. "Not yet," Rand thought. "Soon." Digging his heels into Tidyshar's flanks, he galloped back down toward his army. Dashiva and Flynn followed closely, and Bashir, and the 100 Saldaeans. They were all looking around as if they expected another attempt on his life. To the east, black clouds were building among the peaks. Another Cimarros storm. Soon. The hilltop camp was well laid out, with a meandering stream close by for water and good lines of sight to the likeliest ways into the long mountain meadow. Asid Bakun did not feel pride in the camp. During 30 years in the ever-victorious army, he had made hundreds of camps. He would as soon have felt pride in walking across a room without falling down. Nor did he feel pride in where he was. 30 years serving the Empress, might she live forever, and while there had been the occasional rebellion by some mad upstart with eyes on the crystal throne, the bulk of those years had been spent preparing for this. For 2 generations, while the great ships were built to carry the return, the ever-victorious army had trained and prepared. Bakun certainly had been proud when he learned he was to be one of the forerunners. Surely he could be forgiven dreams of retaking the lands stolen from Arthur Hawkwing's rightful heirs, even wild dreams to completing this new consolidation before the Karen came. Not such a wild dream after all, as it turned out, but not at all the way he had imagined. A returning patrol of 50 Tarabaner lancers rode up the hillside, red and green stripes painted across their solid breastplates, veils of mail hiding their thick mustaches. They rode well, and even fought well, when they had decent leaders. More than 10 times as many were already among the cook fires, or down the picket lines tending their mounts, and 3 patrols were still out. Bakun had never expected to find himself with well over half his command descendants of thieves. And ashamed of it. They would look you straight in the eyes. The patrol's commander bowed low to him as their muddy-legged horses passed, but many of the others went on talking in their peculiar accents, speaking too fast for Bakun to understand without listening hard. They had peculiar notions of discipline, too. Shaking his head, Bakun strode across to the Suldam's large tent. Larger than his, of necessity. 4 of them were sitting on stools outside, in their dark blue dresses with the forked lightning on the skirts, enjoying the sun during this break in the storms. Those were rare enough now. The gray-clad Damani sat at their feet, with Nerith braiding her pale hair. Talking to her as well, all of them joining in and laughing softly. The bracelet on the end of the silvery Edam's leash lay on the ground. Bakun grunted sourly. He had a favorite wolfhound back home, and even talked to him sometimes, but he never expected Nip to carry on a conversation.
"Is she well?"
he asked Nerith, not for the first time, or the tenth.
"Is everything well with her?"
The Damani dropped her eyes and went silent.
"She is quite well, Captain Bakun."
A square-faced woman, Nerith put the proper degree of respect into her voice, and not a whisker beyond. But she stroked the Damani's head soothingly while she talked.
"Whatever the indisposition, it is gone now. A small thing, in any case. Nothing to worry about."
The Damani was trembling. Bakun grunted again, not far from the answer he had received before. Something had been wrong, though, back in Ebudar, and not just with this Damani. The Suldam had all been as tight-lipped as clams, and the blood would not say anything, of course, not to the likes of him. But he had heard too many whispers. They said the Damani were all sick or insane. Light, he had not seen a single one used around Ebudar once the city was secured, not even for a victory display of skylights, and who had ever heard the like of that?
"Well, I hope she..."
he began, and cut off as a rakan appeared, sweeping through the eastern pass. Its great leathery wings beat powerfully for height, and right above the hill it suddenly tilted and cut a tight circle, one wingtip pointed almost straight down. A thin red streamer fell away under the weight of a lead ball. Bakun swallowed a curse. Flyers were always showing off, but if this pair injured one of his men delivering their scouting report, he would have their hides no matter who he had to face to get them. He would not have wanted to fight without flyers to scout, but they were coddled like some blood's favorite pet. Arrow straight, the streamer plummeted. The lead weight struck the ground and bounced on the crest, almost beside the tall, thin message pole, which was too long to lower unless there was a message to send. Besides, when it was left down, somebody was always stepping a horse on the thing and breaking the joins. Bakun strode straight to his tent, but his first lieutenant was already waiting with the mud-stained streamer and the message tube. Tyrus was a bony man, a head taller than him, with an unfortunate scrap of beard clinging to the point of his chin. The report rolled up in the thin metal tube, on a slip of paper Bakun could almost see through, was written simply. He had never been forced to ride on Rakan or Torakan, the light be thanked, and the Empress, might she live forever, be praised. But he doubted it was easy to handle a pen and a saddle strapped to the back of a flying lizard. What it said made him flip open the lid of his small camp desk and write hurriedly.
"There's a force not 10 miles east of here," he told Tyrus. 5 or 6 times our number."
Flyers exaggerated sometimes, but not often by much. How had that many penetrated these mountains so far without being spotted before? He had seen the coast to the east, and he wanted his burial prayers paid before he tried a landing there. Burn his eyes, the flyers boasted they would see a flea move anywhere in the range.
"No reason to think they know we're here, but I'd not mind a few reinforcements."
Tyrus laughed.
"We'll give them a brush of the Damani, and that will be that if they outnumber us by 20 times.
His only real fault was a touch of overconfidence. A good soldier, though.
"And if they have a few Aes Sedai," Bakun said quietly,
hardly stumbling over the name, as he stuffed the flyer's report back into the tube with his own brief message. He had not really believed anyone could let those women run free. Tyrus's face showed that he remembered the tales about an Aes Sedai weapon. The red streamer floated behind him as he ran with the message tube. Soon enough, tube and streamer were attached to the tip of the message pole, a tiny breeze stirring the long red strip 15 paces above the hill crest. The rakan soared toward it, along the valley, outstretched wings still as death. Abruptly, one of the flyers swung down from the saddle and hung, upside down, below the rakan's trailing claws. It made Bakun's stomach hurt to watch. But her hand closed on the streamer, the pole flexed, then vibrated back upright as the message tube pulled free of the clip, and she scrambled back up as the creature climbed in slow circles. Bakun thankfully put Rakan and flyers out of his mind as he surveyed the valley. Broad and long, nearly flat except for this hill, and surrounded by steeped wooded slopes, only a goat could enter, except by the passes in his sight. With the Damani, he could cut anybody to pieces before they managed to try attacking across that muddy meadow. He had passed word along, though. If the enemy came straight on, they would arrive before any possible reinforcements, by 3 days at best. How had they come this far unseen? He had missed the last battles of the Consolidation by 200 years, but some of those rebellions had not been small. 2 years fighting on Merindalar, 30,000 dead, and 50 times that shipped back to the mainland as property. Taking notice of the strange kept a soldier alive. Ordering the camp struck and all signs of it cleared, he began moving his command to the forested slopes. Dark clouds were massing in the east. Another of those cursed storms was coming. Chapter 23. Fog of War, Storm of Battle. No rain fell, for the moment. Rand guided Taidashar around an uprooted tree lying across the slope and frowned down at a dead man sprawled on his back behind the tree trunk. The fellow was short and blocky, his face creased and his armor, all overlapping plates, lacquered blue and green. But staring sightlessly at the black clouds overhead, he looked a deal like Egan Padros, even to the missing leg. An officer, plainly. The sword beside his outflung hand, had an ivory hilt carved in the likeness of a woman, and his lacquered helmet, shaped like some huge insect's head, bore 2 long thin blue plumes. Uprooted trees and shattered ones, a fair number burning from end to end, littered the slope of the mountain for a good 500 paces. Bodies, too, men broken or ripped apart when Sidene harrowed the mountainside. Most wore steel veils across their faces and breastplates painted in horizontal stripes. No women, thank the light. The injured horses had been put down, another thing to be thankful for. It was incredible how loudly a horse could scream.
"Do you think the dead are silent?"
Luce Theron's laugh was rasping.
"Do you?"
His voice turned to pained rage.
"The dead howl at me."
"At me, too," Rand thought sadly. "I can't afford to listen, but how do you shut them up?" Luce Theron began weeping for his lost Ilyena.
"A great victory," Wyroman intoned behind Rand, then muttered, "But small honor in it. The old ways are best."
Mud liberally decorated Rand's coat, yet surprisingly, Wyroman appeared as pristine as he had back on the Silver Road. His helmet and armor shone. How had he managed? The Terrabon is charged, at the end, lances and courage against the one power, and Wyroman had led his own charge to break them. Without orders, and followed by every tyrant save the defenders, even a half-drunk Taurion, surprisingly. By Samaradrid and Gregor and Panar, too, with most of the Carrion and Ilyaners. Standing still had been hard by that time, and every man wanted to come to grips with something he actually could come to grips with. The Ashaman could have done it faster, if somewhat more messily. Rand had taken no part in the fighting, except to sit his saddle where men could see him. He had been afraid to seize the power. He did not dare display weakness for them to catch. Not a scrap. Luce Theron gibbered with horror at the very idea. Equally surprising as Wyroman's unsullied coat, Anaela rode with him, and for once not simpering. Her face was pinched and disapproving. Strangely, it did not spoil her looks nearly so much as her unctuous smiles did. She had not joined the charge herself, of course, any more than Ailill. But Anaela's master of the horse had, and the man was most definitely dead, with a Terrabanner lance through his chest. She did not like that one bit. But why did she accompany Wyroman? Just Tyrans flocking together? Maybe. She had been with Suniman, the last Rand had seen. Bashir walked his bay up the slope, picking his way around the dead while seeming to pay them no more mind than he did a splintered tree trunk or a burning stump. His helmet hung from his saddle, and his gauntlets were stuffed behind his sword belt. He was mud all down his right side, and his horse as well.
"Arakom's gone," he said. "Flynn tried healing him, but I don't think Arakom wanted to live like that. There's near 50 dead so far, and some of the rest might not survive."
Anayla paled. Rand had seen her near Arakom, emptying herself. Dead commoners did not affect her so much. Rand felt a moment of pity. Not for her, and not very much for Arakom. For Min, though she was safely back in Kyrian. Min had foretold Arakom's death from one of her viewings, and Gwaeam and Marakon's too. Whatever she had seen, Rand hoped it had not been anywhere near the reality. Most of the soldiers were off scouting again, but down in the broad meadow, gateways woven by Gedwin's dedicated were spilling out the supply carts and the remounts. The men coming with them gaped as soon as they were clear enough to see. The muddy ground was not so well plowed as the mountainside, yet blackened furrows, 2 paces wide and 50 long, carved through the brown grass, and gaping holes a horse might not be able to leap. They had not found the Damani so far. Rand thought there had to be only one. More would have done considerably greater damage under the circumstances. Men moved around a number of small fires where water boiled for tea, among other things. For once, Tyrans, Kyrianen, and Ilianers mingled. Not just the commoners. Samaradrid was sharing his saddle flask with Gwaeam, who wearily rubbed a hand over his bald head. Marakon and Kirill Drapaneos, a stork of a man whose square-cut beard looked odd on his narrow face, were squatting on their heels near one of the fires, playing cards by the look of it. Torian had a whole circle of laughing Kyrianen lordlings around him, though they might have been less amused by his jokes than by the way he swayed and rubbed at his potato nose. The Legion men kept apart, but they had taken in the volunteers who had followed Padros to the Banner of Light. That lot seemed more eager than anyone since learning how Padros died. Blue-coated Legion men were showing them how to change direction without falling apart like a gaggle of geese. Flynn was among the wounded with Adlai and Moore and Hopwell. Narishma could heal little more than minor cuts, no better than Rand. And Dashiva, not even that. Gedwin and Rochide stood talking well apart from anyone else, holding their horses by the reins atop the hill in the middle of the valley. The hill where they had expected to catch the Seanchan by surprise when they rushed out of gateways surrounding it. Near 50 dead and more to come, but it would have been above 200 without Flynn and the rest who could manage healing to one degree or another. Gedwin and Rochide had not wanted to dirty their hands and grimaced when Rand drove them to it. One of the dead was a soldier, and another soldier, a round-faced Kyrianen, sat slumped beside a fire with a dazed look that Rand hoped came from being tossed through the air by the ground erupting almost under his feet. Down there on the furrowed flats, Ailill was conferring with her lance captain, a pale little man called Denharad.